Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Delighted to have Robert Avily back again. Bob appears often on this program. It's always a riveting hour when Bob comes on. Oh, I think it'll be another one today. So stay tuned and don't touch that dial, as they used to say that I remember back in radio days. Stay with us. You'll get a lot of vital information on the major issues. Certainly the major one of our time with it that I keep repeating is Ukraine. And Bob, I must say, today will be another rarity for me. I've done it a few times before. I'm going to get three articles out tomorrow, but what's even rarer is they're going to all be on the same topic. They're going to be on Ukraine.
There's a lot to say about Ukraine right now, and you can say it a lot of different ways. I think the way that I would like to start is to try to see if we can take a look at NATO's unofficial declaration of war against Russia. I think, for me, all the events in Ukraine line up to that particular thesis, or at least they can be, that thesis can be supported by all the various events. And it really has to do with all the military alliances and the military exercises, they're calling them, that they're either planned or underway for all kinds of different countries in Eastern Europe, Latvia, and Lithuania, and Bulgaria, and now Poland's on board with that. NATO is pressuring Finland and Sweden to end their neutrality, their official neutrality stances. That is all part of this whole process of NATO trying to get at Russia. And in addition, you've got this whole propaganda machine, not just in the United States, but also in Germany, that keeps saying Putin's the bad guy, Putin's the bad guy, he's the aggressor, he's doing all these things. But everything that John Kerry particularly says that Russia is guilty of, the United States is guilty of. And one of my favorite Kerry quotes from recently was last week, when he was testifying before the Senate Relations Committee. He said, I wrote this quote down, so this is a great quote. Quite simply, we see from Russia, what we see from Russia is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis. Now, if there was ever a time that that was sheer hypocrisy, that was one. Because the U.S. has exactly done that in toppling Yanukovych in Ukraine and then putting their own people in place. And if you look at the way the EU handled that back in 2012, the EU Parliament condemned the right sector in the Svoboda Party, the very people that the United States installed in Kiev right now. So here's Kerry saying Russia is doing something illegal and illegitimate, and yet the United States has done the exact same thing, and in duplicitous fashion has turned and condemned any type of influence on Russia's part. So just imperialist lies, imperialist hypocrisy, it keeps on going and going.
Oh, indeed, Bob, and that's exactly true. You can take everything coming out of the White House, out of the hardliners in Congress, out of the State Department, out of the Defense Department, pointing fingers, as I like to say, the wrong way at Russia, and literally these statements and accusations apply to what American policy is. And it's not just what's going on now. It's long-standing. It's certainly post 9/11 especially, but it goes back decades. Everything that happened post World War II, from Korea to Vietnam to African wars to Central American wars to South American wars, the proxy ones like Operation Condor to eliminate progressive operation elements targeting fascist regimes in various countries like Chile, Pinochet, and the generals in Brazil, all kinds of things that went on decades earlier, going back to the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. But everything that's coming out of Washington literally applies to U.S. policies, and it's never, never been worse than today. Bob, let me just explain a little bit what really is the reason for targeting Russia, and the same thing goes with targeting China. You hear it, but less intensively. Obama's so-called Asia pivot is what reflects U.S. policy toward China ahead. The idea is China and Russia are the only major countries that threaten U.S. hegemony. China mostly economically, but it's a powerful military country in its own right, and it has a landmass the size of America's. Of course, Russia's landmass is by far the world's largest. I mean, you can fit America in one part of Russia. I'm not certain how many Americas would fit in Russia. I'm going to have to check that. But the Russian landmass today, even without the former Soviet republics, is huge. literally that landmass made it impossible for Hitler to conquer Russia back in the 1940s. Impossible. I mean, Russia literally, Soviet Russia, Stalin literally moved Russia's industrial might way east in the country, and back then, long-range attacks couldn't target it. So weapons were produced, America supplied more weapons, other Western allies supplied more weapons, and if it wasn't for Russia, heaven help us, Germany might have won that war. Who can tell? But the deal now, well, the deal with Russia today is it's the only powerful military challenger. Russia literally, based on its nuclear and other formidable weapons might and its sophisticated delivery systems, is the only one, even with smaller numbers of all these weapons, it's the only one that can match America blow for blow. Well, you would think it is absolute madness to go to war with either of these countries. Obviously, America's first choice is to marginalize, isolate, weaken them another way. Do it without an all-out conflict. Can an all-out conflict be avoided? Well, I don't know, because great ones start when maybe people who get involved in them never plan, but one thing leads to another to another. World War One was a classic. One got involved with an ally. One ally on one side jumped in, an ally on the other side jumped in. Before you knew it, we had 4 years of war, and a generation of youth was destroyed, about 25 million people or so. And then the war to end all wars, World War Two followed. We had two world wars. Did anybody plan these things? Is it out of the question that we can't have a third one? Of course not. Will anyone plan them? I don't know that anybody will. I mean, America would like to walk over Russia and China easily. You know, minimum casualties, inflicting most of them on Russia and China. If you go back as far as the 1960s, crazies in the Kennedy administration, like General Curtis LeMay, a World War II hero, wanted to nuke Russia when America had an advantage. We had Kennedy president then. Other generals were like LeMay. Kennedy was absolutely outraged by what they wanted. He wanted nothing whatsoever to do with them. But today we have Obama. Obama is in the pocket of militarists. He's one himself. Will he avoid a possible global war? Well, I would hope that he would, but I certainly wouldn't put my money on it. And the best and the worst thing I can say is he's no Jack Kennedy. And Kennedy, as I've said on this program, transformed himself from war maker to peacemaker, and he did it, I don't know at what point in his presidency, but he was only there for a few years. But along the way, before he was assassinated by the CIA, not by Lee Harvey Oswald, the cover story, hopefully enough people know that, before he was assassinated, he absolutely supported peace. He wanted rapprochement with Soviet Russia. He wanted total nuclear disarmament. He wanted all U.S. forces out of Vietnam. He wanted Palestinian rights respected. He wanted a whole lot of other things that if we had them today, America would be fit to live in instead of being unfit to live in. The possibility of a global conflict involving America versus China versus Russia is very, very possible. I'm not predicting it, but it's very, very possible. And I have quoted some very smart people, one in particular, actually more than one in particular, who said they don't see how it can be avoided. Scary talk, absolutely scary talk. And these people were brilliant. They're not living now. They made their predictions two or three decades ago, pre-9/11. And things are so much worse today than they ever were then. And if that's the road that they saw America heading on way back then, just imagine if they were living today what they would say. So the possibility of global war is real. America's key objective is eliminating its most key rivals. It wants all independent states removed. But, you know, the easier ones are Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria. Well, Syria is proving not to be so easy, but Syria certainly is no Russia or China. Venezuela is no pushover because of the overwhelming popular support from the great majority of the people who already aborted a U.S.-led ouster of Hugo Chavez in 2002. Lasted 2 days before street protests and Venezuelan military middle ranks, maybe some higher ranks, but mostly middle ranks and lower level recruits, absolutely wouldn't tolerate the guy they respected being ousted. The same scenario exists today. But Russia and China are different. They're powerful. You may or may not be able to target the independent states and oust them, but trying it against Russia and China risks the worst or potential possible outcomes, global war, World War III. But that's America's goal. That's been the goal for many, many decades. You never hear a word about that in the major media. But that's a long-standing goal against Russia since the end of World War II, against China once its economic ascendancy was seen. And that began taking place maybe in the 1990s. It was only at the end of the 1970s that Deng Xiaoping, the leader at that time, shifted China's policy, making statements like, he didn't care what color a cat was. He only cared about one that would catch mice. He wanted China transformed into an economic powerhouse. He wanted a different China than the one he inherited. And it's certainly heading in that direction, and it scares the living daylights out of America. So China is very much on America's target list. Heaven help us what may come, Bob. That's the issue of America versus both of these countries. And it means the risk of a global war is absolutely real.
That part I agree completely with. And the reasons, the causes underneath it, in terms of the United States being the aggressor nation in this case, I think that's almost irrefutable at this point, although I talked to Obama supporters who would deny that vehemently. But nonetheless, I think that there's two things that are going on with the United States, and particularly with Obama and John Kerry and the Obama administration generally. I'm going to go back and grab something from Chalmers Johnson here in one of his texts where he talks about hubris as being the cause of a lot of this overstretch of military and this imperialism. And if you listened to, watched, or read about the interview that Obama did on CBS News this past week with Major Garrett, he said a couple of things that I thought were incredibly ignorant. I mean, you've referred to him as a damn fool last time we talked. That's what you're referring to. And I thought, you know, it's kind of, I don't know if it's foolish, but it's certainly, I think, irresponsible when Obama says, Russia wouldn't dare go to war with us. I mean, he had this really kind of cocky response to one of Major Garrett's questions. They wouldn't go to war with us because they know that our weapons are superior. And I think that's foolish, foolhardy, and I also think it's very aggressive. And when Russia reads that or sees that, they're not going to take kindly to it. And if you look at Russian military doctrine, as Stephen Cohen talks about, their military doctrine says that when they're confronted by overwhelming conventional forces, they reserve the right to use nuclear weapons. So here's Obama saying, they'll never take us on. And if the United States encroaches into eastern Ukraine, let's say, and Russia decides to respond and the United States escalates it, Russia guarantees itself the right to use nuclear weapons, as does the United States. You got a very tinderbox here, a very tender situation in which you could have a major catastrophe as a result of all of this. That's the other part about American push. It's not just hubris. I don't think they care. I think the leaders in the American military and the nuts that are behind this push to aggression and war just don't care because they think we win no matter what. And that's what you got out of Obama. The major thing I took from the Major Garrett interview on CBS was that Obama doesn't care because he thinks this is a lock for the United States. We'll get it. We'll knock them over. We're superior. We've got NATO behind us. And then John Kerry on the other side, again testifying before Congress, talks about every problem in Ukraine being due to Putin's meddling. Well, if you look carefully at the whole history of Ukraine, as Stephen Cohen does, I'm going to quote Stephen Cohen again because I like his studies of Russian history. He says that there's been basically three Ukraines, and that Ukraine has been divided since it was formed as a country between the pro-Russian Ukraine and the other Ukraines. It can't possibly be the case that Russia created that. It can't possibly be the case that Putin is fomenting that. That's already there. And then so you send the CIA guy over, John Brennan, and you say, talk to our new government and tell them that we've got to stop this Russian influence. It's not the Russian influence there that's the problem. It's the American influence there. When they go in ignorantly and just say, okay, we're taking over here, here's the new sheriff, but you've got three different parties that are involved in the situation in Ukraine, you don't take over that easily. And then talking about that same thing moving over to Venezuela, since you talked about that, on April 15th, President Maduro celebrated his first anniversary as president by talking about the fact that the United States was attempting a coup against him, and that the whole idea was to throw over Venezuela's oil reserves back into American control, and that way they could dominate Russia, China, and India. Now, that's what Maduro said. And he said, if the United States is successful, that's going to sink the economies of 18 different Caribbean countries who rely on Venezuela. So the whole point is, here comes the United States again. So far, Maduro seems to be holding off that kind of push of the right wing coming, while at the same time he's capitulating to some of the things that they're requiring, like that he works with the right wing that's supported by the United States to solve Venezuela's economic problems and take posts in government and things like that. That's the camel's nose under the tent type of thing that the United States is trying to do, and Maduro's giving them that little bit of room, hoping to prevent a coup from occurring. And then the China issue that you were talking about 10 days ago, almost 2 weeks ago now, when Chuck Hagel, the U.S. Defense Secretary, met with his counterpart in China, they had a very public confrontation that ended in Hagel actually waggling his finger at his counterpart, Defense Minister in China. What's his name? Chang Wangfang.
Oh, I don't know his name.
But Hagel's wagging his finger at him. Now, that's insulting and very aggressive, and telling him point blank, the Philippines and Japan are part of the United States, you know, kind of thing. We've got long treaties with them, and if you get in the way, we'll do what we need to do. Well, that's very provocative. And so you've got these constant calls on the United States for China to be more transparent in their cyber activities and for Russia to follow international law. And we do precisely the opposite in each of these cases. But in the case of China, Russia, Venezuela, America is clearly the aggressor. We're using a lot of different ways to do it, and each one of those could easily be a tinderbox to lead to a major conflagration, and you got a world war, because those are three different areas of the world. That pretty much encompasses the world. So there you got it.
Oh, indeed so, and it just makes things scarier and scarier. And I agree with you, the stuff that comes out of Obama's mouth, I literally cannot stand listening to him. I quote him often, but I pick it up when I see it in print, and I handle it, the printed word, but to listen to the words coming out of his mouth, I can't stand hearing them. He's a con man. He's a serial liar. He's a moral coward. He's a war criminal multiple times over. I could go on and on and on, and he's been this way from day one in office. He made one promise after another, and literally, I've tracked it, I've written about it, I've exposed it. Every single major promise he made, he broke. No exceptions. Some smaller ones maybe he kept, but the biggest ones of all, and it's more than a few, it's two or three dozen or more, major stuff, important stuff, and there he is in black and white. I've got the quotes promising this kind of stuff, including one on the campaign trail. I think it was in fall 2007, as a candidate, he made a statement about Afghanistan, that if U.S., I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but I've used it a couple of times, and it goes to the effect that if American troops and out of Afghanistan, when he becomes president, he will remove them. And his punchline was, and I do remember these words, and you can take that to the bank, fall 2007. They're still there. Are they coming out at the end of 2014? Answer, no. Probably a drawdown. Fewer there now than months earlier, than a year earlier. But Obama wants maybe as many as 30,000 kept there. Will he get them? Sure. There'll be a new appointed president elected. No elected president in Afghanistan. I wrote about the elections. Every post 9/11 election in Afghanistan was rigged. The only difference was how much one was compared to the others. The last presidential election was farcical. The one that was just held a couple of weeks ago, farcical. I don't know who's going to win it. We're told. Well, my God, they have an election in April, and we're told we won't know who the winner is until October. There'll be a runoff election because nobody's going to get a majority, so there'll be a runoff election, I think, around the end of May. And I don't know how they count the votes there, Bob, but they're still counting now from the election a few weeks ago, and then they'll have to account from the runoff election. And literally, I quoted from a couple of articles saying they won't know who the winner is until October. Well, my answer to that is, who gives a damn?
Yeah, and it, we all know what the end result is going to be anyway. It's the same as getting a government installed in Ukraine. So
exactly.
It looks to me like that's just one part of the whole push of the bourgeoisie, as a Marxist would call it, the top executives, the top earners of the United States who control the government, who are pushing out for more and more control in all areas of the world so that they can have the resources. And their condition just keeps improving and improving over and above everyone else's. So you got Obama, who can't justify anything that he's doing under a rubric of justice or law or rule of law, so he's got to lie in order to do it. And in the meantime, you have professors from UC Berkeley who just last month came out with a study talking about what the current economic state is in America, and the wealthiest 0.5% saw their share of wealth double from about 1980 to last year, and everybody else has been thrust way down economically. But now we have 16%, according to this study, 16% of young people ages 25 to 34 is what they, this category, have incomes that now fall below the federal poverty rate. And then you go the other way again, 10% of the people in that same age group were in poverty in 2000. So you have one direction for everybody else in society, and then one direction for the top 1% or so. And that's who Obama's trying to cover in all these lies. So it's not just that he's a liar, which is certainly, I think, true, but the he's lying in order to cover his own crimes, which are done for the oligarchy that he serves in his administration. And the statistics bear that out. They're the ones, that, this top 1%, they're the ones that want those resources in Ukraine and Afghanistan and elsewhere, and they're the ones that Obama's working for. So if you call the United States a democracy, you have to explain that. How is it that the United States can have such deep and ongoing and widening inequality, have a president, a judiciary, and a legislative branch of government that all work for these individuals, small number of individuals, carry out their doings in foreign policy by going to war, and yet we call ourselves a democracy? I think we need to take a very close look at that and tie it to Afghanistan and tie it to Syria and tie it to Ukraine, because that underscoring all that, that's what the problem is. It's the elites here that run that show, and they don't do it for us.
Absolutely, Bob, and there's another major, there's so many major issues, including the ones that go on at home, you know, aside from looting the U.S. economy to enrich banks is another corporate favorite, that was the topic of the two books I wrote, Wall Street Fleeces America and Banker Occupation. I mean, important stuff that literally gets such short shrift in any kind of coverage at all, and even I haven't discussed it enough on this program. I'm going to have to go back and revisit that and have an economist come on and discuss this, because it's such a major issue, and I have an article I just wrote yesterday that I'm not certain when I'll get it out, because of breaking news kind of stuff like articles on Ukraine take precedence. I want to get those out before the story, before the information goes stale. But the title of my article I haven't gotten out yet, and I certainly won't hold it too long. I've written about this topic before a few times, and the new one is called America's Hidden Hunger Crisis. It's almost impossible, you would think, to imagine the richest country in the world having a major hunger crisis and hiding it. And the official numbers go back to 2012. They'll be updated later this year in a new Feeding America study. I'm not certain what year it's based on. Maybe based on last year's data. But the numbers are way understated. Just the way the unemployment numbers are not whatever the official number is, 6.8%, whatever it is. Bald-faced lie. The official unemployment rate exceeds 23%, and if you include the underemployment rate, you can more than double that number, maybe triple that number, because most jobs created in America are rotten ones, low pay, temp, or part-time jobs with few or no benefits, the kind that you need at least two of, and still you have a hard time making ends meet, so much so that most of the people enduring a hunger crisis of people with jobs, families, some with more than one wage earner. And this is what I cover in my article. So the article, based on 2012 data, says nearly 50 million Americans are affected, around 13 million families. One in five children, and in my own state of Illinois, I've got the number in my head, 22.2% of Illinois children face hunger problems. They don't, their parents don't know where their next meal is coming from. In a city like Chicago, within walking distance of where I live downtown, I literally can go into a neighborhood where there are kids who literally have empty bellies. Empty bellies. And I can go back home, and there's enough food for me to eat, and I've got other problems on my mind. But one thing isn't hunger. It isn't getting medical care. But considering the way America is run, Bob, I have no idea what I'll be facing in the months to come, in the years to come, if I live that long. But there are so many millions in America, the great majority, who go through such duress because of horrid U.S. policies, and they suffer so much, and they're mostly low-income or unemployed people who deserve so much more. And as bad as America was, as flawed as it was when I grew up in it, Bob, in the late 1930s and the 1940s, 1950s, it was so much different then, 1960s even, so much different then than the way it is now. When I got out of school in February 1960, there was a soft economy. I had no trouble in the world getting a decent job. Okay, I had an MBA, but MBAs don't have a soft time getting jobs today. I don't know what they go through. If I was a newly minted MBA today, Bob, I'd be very concerned about what I had. When I finished in February of 19, well, I finished at the end of 1959. I graduated in early February 1960. I took one day off, just to, I guess, reorient myself to the normal world out of the grind that I went through, compacting a 2-year MBA curriculum into a year and a half, including a summer, and doing an MBA thesis. Why did I do that? Because I was starving. I was tired of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every day for lunch. I mean, literally, that's what my lunch was every day. I couldn't afford anything else. I lived in a boarding house. At the beginning, the food was fine. The food got rotten. They served me breakfast. They served the people in the boarding house, mostly students, breakfast and dinner. We were on our own for lunch, and for me, it was peanut butter and jelly. I never wanted to look a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the face again after that. So I wanted a job. I needed an income. I wanted to go to work. I wanted something better than peanut butter and jelly. That's why I took one day off, Bob, and went to work and had no trouble finding it in a soft economy. Very, very tough today.
Very tough today, because one of the things that you're finding is that there is no investment going on today. So that you don't expand the productive capacity, so you can't grow. What's happening is corporations are sitting on their money and investing it back into the stock market. And what they do is that they're not financing any productive capacity. They're just buying back shares and inflating their own wallets at the same time. So you can't go out and get a job, which is the kind of standard thing, right? The go get a job type of thing. But you can't do it if there's no investment going on in order to create those jobs. And that reminds me of something that I had read a couple weeks ago. The International Monetary Fund had their annual report called the World Economic Outlook, and they said in that report that there was no prospect for any growth rates that would in any way return to the pre-2007 levels. And that's worldwide. That includes the United States. So they say that all the evidence suggests that there's going to be a full reversal. Any evidence that would suggest that there's a full reversal coming is very unlikely. So even the IMF says there's not going to be any change. In fact, the other way is likely, as they say in their own report. So here's the fund that actually controls all this stuff. They're doing their own study saying, you know, it doesn't look very good. It's pretty grim right now. And so even when they come out and say that, you know, you got to put it in your hands. And at the same time, you've got employee pensions in the United States under attack, both private and public pensions, which we can talk about. The New York Times has written about this as well. And that really kind of goes back to the Bush administration when they kind of changed some of the laws, which we can talk about. You've got an assault on health care that's called Obamacare. And you've got an ongoing assault on voting rights in pretty much the majority of states. The way I count the studies, about 29 states right now are involved in attempting to limit the ability of people to participate in their own democracy. So you got three things going on besides the economic thing that we're talking about, regarding that no investment going on, no growth, no jobs. They're making it so that there is no back end in terms of pension, and you got to get no health care because you can't pay the $5,000, $6,000 deductibles that Obamacare would require, and you can't vote anybody out of office unless you've got the exact right type of identification and you live in the right state. A lot of problems here.
Oh, indeed, Bob. We'll go into a break in just a moment. Let me just mention one thing very briefly. I just noticed this shortly before we went on air. The former boxer, Hurricane Reuben Carter, died either yesterday. It was just announced by the New York Times. I spotted a bulletin that was sent to me. And the reason I mentioned him was he spent 19 years in prison for a crime, murder, for a crime he did not commit, and he got out. And I just got an email from Francis Boyle. He said he wanted to commemorate his death, and he said, quote, Hurricane and I worked together to save the life of Canadian citizen Mr. Stanley Faulkner from being executed in the United States. Hurricane personally presented and argued my, meaning Boyle's, memorandum of law to Canadian Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy that Canada sued the United States at the International Court of Justice to save Mr. Faulkner's life. I, meaning Boyle, could not be there because of his teaching commitments. Axworthy chickened out. Mr. Faulkner was killed. But Hurricane and Boyle fought together for his life to the bitter end. So Hurricane deserves to be commemorated on this day of his death. He was 76 years old, 19 years in prison for nothing. He's not the only one who's gone to prison for not having committed the crime that they were claimed to have committed. Not just murder, but many other crimes. And it's why I say repeatedly that thousands of innocent political prisoners languish in America's gulag. We need to go to break. We'll take the break right now. We'll come back and we'll pick it right up, Bob, on the other side. Welcome back. On with Robert Abele, talking about so many different things. I just mentioned Reuben Carter, and I just emailed Francis Boyle back in that break, telling him that I just quoted him on air, and I think Reuben Carter deserved it, and Francis Boyle also, because Francis, as I like to say, is on the right side of history, supporting the right things, the rule of law, and those kind of things. You know, the things that America, Obama, the other people in Washington, consider old-fashioned and quaint. Well, rules of law are never old-fashioned and quaint. They're put there for a reason, and the people who break those laws are criminals. They belong in prison, and as I like to say about that, the ones like Obama and Bush and the other officials supporting them, they belong in prison, not high office. Does justice turn out that way? Well, not in my lifetime, maybe in a future one. Anyway, Bob, so much. What else should we talk about? Well, the Afghanistan story indeed that does continue going on, and I don't believe anything is going to change much once whatever happens at the end of the year. There'll be a new Afghan stooge, U.S. stooge, taking over as president, the same way as there is an Iraqi stooge in Baghdad. Hamid Karzai will be leaving, I guess, as the new stooge is appointed, and he's a former CIA asset and a former Union Oil consultant. It shows you the kind of leaders America installs in the countries it wants to dominate, and the war on Syria goes on, and in one of my three articles tomorrow, which is about Canada's involvement in Obama's wars, in all of them, going back to Afghanistan, Iraq, and the least of all was Iraq, supporting Iraq, but not directly involvement with Canadian troops, but the Libyan war, recent reports within recent days said that Stephen Harper, the fascist prime minister of Canada, what else can you call him? I mean, he's a madman like Obama, extremist, reckless. Reports in the Canadian media saying documents that have been heavily redacted, but enough information in them to suggest that that HAPA is planning military involvement with America against Syria. I'll be watching this very closely to see what happens, because all along, when Obama postponed his war on Syria last summer, end of August, early September, I absolutely didn't believe that he canceled it. I believe that he did postpone it for a later date. Just the way they make up a ball game that gets rained out, Obama will make up a war that he wants to wage, hasn't done it. He's done everything else but direct U.S. involvement, what I call Libya 2.0, giving the fascist thugs on the ground their own air force, ravaging another country more than already. The war is in its fourth year. It could go on much longer, even though the Syrian forces have really taken command of things. They're routing these insurgents that have come in from dozens of countries. The insurgents waging this war are largely not homegrown. The local Syrians, the ones who oppose the sitting government, Bashar Assad, and they're growing fewer in number all the time, they're mostly non-belligerent. They want to solve things diplomatically. They're tired of war, and it's hard to get good polls out of Syria, but the last one I saw, of all places, came out of an organization funded by NATO, and it said roughly 70% of Syrians support Assad. 70% is why Washington absolutely does not want a legitimate election. And there's one coming up, and there was one over a year ago. And Assad and his allies won in a cakewalk, a legitimate election, independently monitored from monitors around the world, and they reported on it, and they said it was scrupulously open, free, and fair. But of course, the U.S. media and Washington and Western countries don't recognize it. There's going to be another election. Assad is running. He said he will, as long as Syrians want him to. And if they don't want him to, he will step down and let somebody else run. Well, he's going to be overwhelmingly elected again. The results will be absolutely legitimate. They'll be debased and debunked by U.S. politicians, other Western ones, the scoundrel media. But he's going to continue as president because Syrians won't trust that job to anyone else. And they certainly don't want a U.S. stooge appointed. So that's what's going on in Syria. That's the threat that all independent countries face. Venezuelans face it if America gets its way. What's going on in Ukraine, we've got the fascists running things temporarily, Bob, but the idea is to have a fake election and simply replace the sitting fascists with new ones. So, you know, everything changes but stays the same. That's the plan.
And going back to how you began your comments, the Obama administration picking up in Libya began this process that Obama calls leading from behind. And the leading from behind issue is getting our proxies to subvert the process going on in that particular country and to put it in complete turmoil, and then allow NATO forces, really U.S. forces that call themselves NATO, to move into that particular country. And the same thing is going on with Syria now, because according to the Washington Post, and I read this probably a couple weeks ago by now, but the U.S. is actually doubling down on trying to get its proxy war in Syria relaunched, as it were, because they've doubled the number of fighters that they're putting into the U.S.-run camps in Jordan and Saudi Arabia and even Qatar. And from now on, Obama has shifted to CIA taking charge of those military camps instead of the Army and the Air Force. And then you tie that in with Seymour Hersh's article that exposes Turkey's providing support for the opposition and being involved in the war, and Turkey's involvement in the chemical weapons attack that Hersh was talking about in his article. And then you add Israel and some of the other countries that are around, Saudi Arabia and Jordan, and their whole push to overthrow Assad. You've got the leading from behind thing that Obama so much likes. And if it gets to the point that it's not working, which is clearly the case right now, Assad seems to have stabilized and has kind of won the day so far, then I think what you're going to see is the United States claiming humanitarian intervention. Because they're going to say, well, you know, we got a couple hundred thousand people that because of Assad are on the run right now and they're homeless and all that, so we need to go in for a humanitarian intervention. And I think that's the next step. And so you undermine the belly of the country that you're trying to get And then once their belly is exposed, then you stab them. And you use humanitarian. I'm stabbing you in a humanitarian fashion. And I think that's what you're going to get. You even have articles in The Nation that have been talking about that. Use force, save the starving Syrians and all that stuff. So I think that's what you end up with in Syria. And people like Seymour Hersh exposes that for the lies that they are.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. And a comment I've made many times in articles throughout the Syrian conflict, I've said that Syria is Obama's war. That's a comment I repeat all the time. Syria absolutely is Obama's war. He didn't plan it. It was planned long before he came into office. It was planned pre-9/11. And the culprit, I believe, was Paul Wolfowitz, literally a Machiavellian figure, if there ever was one in U.S. Geopolitics, an outrageous figure, a guy who's still around. And I believe he was the Machiavellian figure behind the wars on Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, the ones yet to be fought, Iran, Sudan, whatever else, Venezuela, the others, literally to depose independent governments, to replace them with pro-Western stooge ones. That's the dirty game. So Obama just picked up the mantle. Bush waged his wars. Obama is waging his wars. Whatever is left will be passed on to his successors. I mean, the beat just goes on, keeps going on endlessly, Bob, one after another. There was another comment I wanted to make, and I forget exactly what it was, but literally these aggressive wars repeat one after another, and it's horrible, and we're heading for something much worse that's already happened. I'll think of what I meant to say, and I'll come back and mention it, but I'll pass it back to you, Bob.
Well, I would like to talk for just a minute, because I want to be a little bit specific. I started talking about, at the beginning of the show, with John Kerry trying to hold Russia's feet to the fire regarding international law. Well, in the joint project that you and I are working on right now, Stephen, coming up later, we've got all we have to do is go to what international law says about the right to self-determination. And you can go all the way back to, actually go back to 1960, but I'll start in 1970 from UN General Assembly Resolution 2625, which says that no state or group of states has the right to intervene directly or indirectly for any reason whatsoever in the internal or external affairs of another state. Now, if Kerry wants to hold the feet to the fire of international law, he's got to start there. That's the beginning of the right to self-determination of a state that the United States is in constant violation of. And so when it comes to military intervention, international law is equally as clear. And the World Court, too, the International Court of Justice has stated, actually this goes back to the 1980s, that the definition of intervention includes indirect form of support for subversive or terrorist armed activities within that other state. There is international law. It prohibits any type of interference in the self-determination of a state, and it prohibits any type of direct or indirect support for any type of subversive activities in that state by another state. And when you raise that to the level of actually going to war, unless you are directly being attacked or about to be attacked where it's imminent, you don't have any justification to send military into harm's way anywhere. That would be called a war of aggression. And UN General Assembly Resolution 3314 defines it very specifically as any military incursion by one nation into another in any manner inconsistent with the United Nations Charter. So there's your international law that Kerry keeps saying, Russia's got to follow this, Russia's got to follow this, and Hegel's wagging his finger at China saying, you better follow international law. There's international law. What's the United States doing about that? Well, I think it's pretty clear, just what we talked about today, what the United States is doing in that regard. And they're not following it even to the spirit, let alone the letter that they're holding everybody else to.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. And I've said exactly the same thing that you did. This non-intervention legal principle is included in a lot of international law. Most important is the UN Charter, and of course that's post-World War II, but it goes back to the 1930s era Montevideo Convention. Montevideo Convention spells it out very clearly. And in the UN Charter, the only non-intervention exception is if a nation comes under attack, it has the right to self-defense, but only until the Security Council acts, so it's a temporary right. The Security Council, not the U.S. Congress, not the parliaments of any other country, Only the Security Council can authorize a military attack by one nation against another, and it would only be in self-defense. But it again has to be emphasized, as final say, no other legal authority, but you never hear that mentioned or hinted at in anything discussed in the U.S. media. You hear the opposite, you know, humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect. What rubbish, Bob. What absolute rubbish.
Yeah, it's total rubbish, and you got the same thing going on in Canada, as you mentioned, too, and I think we should highlight that as well. That Canada has been on board with the United States in this same type of propaganda push, and now the same military push. Actually, Canada's involvement started back in 1999 when they were very much a player in the U.S.-led war on Yugoslavia.
Oh, you bet. You bet.
So we can go back that far with Canada's involvement. So this announcement by Harper this week that he's sending six F-16 jet fighters, I think it is, to Eastern Europe, that's just part of and parcel of what Canada's ongoing participation with the United States is on all of this. And it's all for the oligarchs that run the country. So you can list off all the things that Harper talked about, but the thing that really kind of bothers me is that here in Australia and New Zealand, where we've got these kind of satellite partners that are going into these operations with the United States, the alleged opposition to that particular party, Harper's party, as well as the parties in New Zealand and Australia, say nothing. And if they say anything at all, it tends to be very supportive of what it is that that particular prime minister is engaged in doing. So if you don't have any pushback from the parties that be, this is going on in Germany too, by the way, there's no pushback from other parties. Everybody seems to be on the same political board. Yes, let's move militarily forward. Now you got really an unimpeded stampede to the direction of war. There's no stopping it. And you got the same thing going on in Canada.
Oh, without question, Bob. And Yugoslavia was very important. That was Bill Clinton's war. And Bill Clinton committed so many other acts of aggression, including the so-called Rwanda genocide that was another U.S. war against the people of Rwanda. The official story, a bald-faced lie, and the real story, America's goal to drive out French influence from the region, more than just Rwanda, drive out French influence from the region and replace it with U.S. Influence. And that goes back 1993 or so. Bill Clinton's wars. Bill Clinton waged a lot of wars you never heard about. The bombing of Iraq intermittently throughout the 1990s. The sanctions that killed on the order of at least 5,000 Iraqi children every single month. Genocide. Mostly kids under 5 years of age. Starving them to death. Probably 1.5 million deaths. Iraqi deaths. Murder. Cold-blooded murder. Bill Clinton responsible throughout the 1990s. And how many Americans know about that? It's all there in black and white. UN humanitarian coordinators, two of them, quit because of this. One of them said he wanted no part of genocide committed against the Iraqi people, and that's exactly what went on. And then in 1999, from March to June, 78 days, intensive bombing, enormous amounts of munitions dropped. I wrote a commemorative article about it in March, 24th of March, I believe it began. My article came out the day after. I call it the rape of Yugoslavia. That's exactly what it was. And Canada, under I believe it was Jean Chrétien back then, a so-called liberal prime minister, Canada partnered with Washington's war of aggression, and literally the country was ravaged and destroyed, Serbia, Kosovo, and the people there still have not recovered. Many, many killed, many lives destroyed, their futures destroyed, and all these years later, none of this has been reported. Literally, an independent country was transformed into another U.S. colony, thanks in part to the actions of Canada, but of course America, the lead belligerent, and this repeats time after time after time, worst of all since 9/11, but you could go back literally since World War II and see one aggressive war after another. The Korean War, one comment, wasn't the North Koreans that began the Korean War, it was the South Koreans at the behest of Harry Truman. That's the true story of the Korean War.
I'm going to make two quick comments. Number one was when you mentioned Rwanda, I find it really interesting in the last couple of weeks in particular, I've read a couple of stories about this, that Bill Clinton is trying to rewrite his involvement by deflecting the criticism you just made by saying, the only mistake I made was in not calling it a genocide soon enough. That's his standard drumbeat line now, that I just made a mistake by not calling it what it was. He kept from that because of all the legal ramifications of calling it a genocide, of course, but he's not saying anything about what his active role was. He's just saying, oh, I just didn't put the right word on it, you know, so that's what you get when you have a president who lies to cover up his crimes. And you're right, they should be in jail for that. They should at least have been put on trial for that. Those are international crimes of aggression.
Oh, absolutely. Crimes of war against humanity and genocide. Genocide against innocent people. And I remember the presidents of two countries, Rwanda and Burundi, were on an aircraft, and the CIA shot it down because they wanted to kill the Rwandan president. I believe it was the Rwandan one president. And they installed their stooge, a guy named Paul Kagame, who was trained at Fort Leavenworth in America, a Rwandan general, I think he was. They trained him at Fort Leavenworth. They groomed him to become the fascist head of Rwanda, ahead of this Clinton genocide against the Rwandan people. And that's the true story of America that gets whitewashed from U.S. history books. You never get it anyplace else. You get it on this program.
That's right. You had also mentioned North Korea, and I find it interesting what's going on there, interesting in a kind of a lightweight term to say. I find it kind of disturbing that, and I'm trying to put this together, piece this together issue by issue or event by event. And if you go back to the United States' annual military exercises with South Korea, which just ended yesterday, I think it was called Key Resolve or Full Eagle or something like that. It had a couple different names for it. It began in February. You get this type of process that the United States is using in Southeast Asia where they start with a military exercise that directly threatens a regime right next door, in this case North Korea. And then North Korea, or that regime, in this case North Korea, responds by doing something like firing test rockets, which is what North Korea did, two medium-range ballistic missiles. And then you've got one of the United States' allies, in this case Japan, speaking for the United States, saying, we will just shoot down any missile that we see going up in the air. And so you get this constant escalation. And the United States is hoping that you can get this provocation that will allow them to turn the military exercises into a direct form of aggression. So the United States exploits all these situations and keeps pushing and prodding and pushing. And then when someone reacts because they're pushing, then the fist comes with that. So now you've got this constant drumbeat going on, and the United States keeps doing this. And now they've got Abe, the president of Japan, saying, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. If we see anything North Korea sends up in the air, we're going to shoot it down. And fortunately, that didn't happen, and now the military exercises are over. But then you got China doing the same thing with their declaring their air zone. What does the United States do? Puts B-52s through the air zone, the zone that China has claimed for itself, and it hopes that it can trigger a response to allow the United States to move in. So you've got all these things going on. We haven't even talked about Israel yet, but you've got all these other things going on. If the United States is behind, they're massaging, they're poking, and if it comes to pass, we're going to end up looking like Germany did before World War II, because we're the ones that are doing all of this. We just haven't sent our military there directly like Hitler did. And that comparison is so trite now, because everybody always makes it that the most evil you can do is to compare somebody to Hitler. But that's really what we're doing. We just haven't done it with our military directly, that's all.
The only difference between Obama and Hitler is the mustaches and the color of their skin, Bob. Nothing else other than that. And we're getting very short in time. I wanted to mention a quick aside, going back to the Korean War for a minute. I have a book that I consider a treasure sitting on my shelf. It was written by I.F. Stone. He wrote it while the war was ongoing. It's called The Hidden History of the Korean War. He basically exposed the war as a war of the Truman-instigated South against the North. But the war was still ongoing. He wanted more information, but he had plenty in his book. And the reason I treasure the book is I bought it years ago, used, for $10. And to my astonishment, when I opened it up, I.F. Stone wrote the book again, the great journalist of a past era. He died in 1989. When I opened the book, to my delight and astonishment, I discovered that he autographed the book. What damn fool bought a book that I.F. Stone autographed and sold it for what, $2 at a bookstore? And I was lucky enough years later to buy it for $10. I wouldn't sell it for $100, probably not for $200. And that book sits on my shelf, and it's going to sit on my shelf till the day I pass on.
Wow. That's pretty good. You got
that really is amazing.
Absolutely
amazing to see that. I'm still in awe at the fact that I've got a book that he autographed.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. And he's one of those, what do you call him, muckraking journalists?
Yes.
Oh, that like Seymour Hersh does. So,
yes.
He's somebody that was listened to in his day, and that kind of journalism is what we need today instead of, you know, one of the things that I've noticed about the current media is that they keep referring to Russian state-run media. Well, in our case, it's not run by the state, so if you're going to describe it accurately, you should say American state-allied media, because you get the same type of thing, and that's kind of what I.F. Stone was trying to get at, and that's what Seymour Hersh tries to get at, this idea that we're not getting a full story because they're not telling us what it is that protects the elite. So I think that's a wonderful thing.
That certainly is absolutely true, Bob, and I remember an article I wrote years ago I titled Paid Liars, and I referred to the major media. I mean, these people are literally paid liars. They're paid to lie, they don't tell the truth, and you could go through any of the major publications, turn on U.S. television, and see the kind of rot that passes as news. It's nothing but garbage, baloney, misinformation, bald-faced lies, give it any name you want. Who was the one? Paul Craig Roberts uses the term prostitutes. I think it goes back to who was a journalist who used it? Well, another journalist of bygone era, George Selders, back who was older, who lived to 105, as I remember. He died, I believe, in the mid 1990s. Goes back to the 19th century. Interviewed Mussolini before World War II. He interviewed other world leaders. That's the kind of guy he was, and he used the term prostitutes. Paul Greig Roberts used prostitutes, and I made a comment that literally, compared to these prostitutes make street whores look respectable by comparison, and it doesn't matter whether they're from Fox News or the New York Times or the Washington Post. They're all in bed on the wrong side of history. We're just about out of time, Bob. Final comment.
Oh, gosh, there's so many final comments of areas we haven't gotten to yet, but if you want to, I'll just tie this into what you were just talking about regarding a press that doesn't do anything but present the state view. If you look at what Obama's been saying in some of his speeches about the Affordable Care Act, the ACA or Obamacare, he's lied one lie after the other and not really been telling the truth. And the biggest lie, I think, is that he says that this is a reform that's on a par with Medicare. That's actually just the opposite of that. If you look at the details of the ACA, one of the things that clearly stand out is that they're making decisions now on the basis of how much it's going to cost them to make a person better, or how long will they live after being treated in a particular way in terms of the cost. So it's all a cost-benefit thing. That's not something that you see in Medicare. That's using the kind of the British system of quality-adjusted life year. Where how long can we make this person live? Is it going to cost us too much? Well, we don't want to pay that much for this person to live. Cut them out. That's Obamacare, and that's what the media just broadcasts Obama's speeches and his lines without even questioning anything that's going on there. That's a big problem.
Absolutely, Bob. We're out of time, and I can tell people about Medicaid because I've been on it for about a dozen years, and I know what Medicare is. It keeps getting worse all the time, but I know what Medicare is. I know what I was promised. I know what I'm getting. I'm getting a hell of a lot better than the people on Obamacare, most people. Bob, we're out of time. I've got to sign off. Many, many thanks. I'll send you an email.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Join us. I want to repeat, we are archived Thursdays and Fridays. The programs are in my archives on PRN's website. Sunday is always live, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make all these programs a regular habit.